happy Friday, and what a Friday it is with all the news coming out of Washington, D.C. Holy cow. Earlier this week, the House and the Senate both passed a short-term spending bill that would avoid a government shutdown. That bill did not include $5 billion in funding for the president's border wall. On Thursday, President Trump said he wouldn't sign it, and without his signature on a spending bill, the government will shut down at midnight tonight. I spoke with Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan earlier and asked her all about it.
Well, it is certainly unusual to embrace a shutdown at Christmas time that would leave a quarter of the government unfunded, furloughed, and unpaid. But it's also, you know, the situation we're in where the president who has been elected may have an R next to his name, but he is not ideologically aligned on many points with his own party. He is a disruptor. He is out there saying, I'm going to do what I said I was going to do, which is build this border wall. And that is the little add-on here that has caused the funding conversation to be tripped up. The president won't sign any funding bill unless it includes $5 billion for his border wall. Right. He called Nancy Pelosi's bluff. He showed he did have the votes in the House among Republicans to get it through. The question now is, what is going to happen in the Senate? So many senators have gone home for the holidays already, so right. It's not clear who would show up. And Senate Democrats say they have enough votes to block it. So now you have the standoff, and the president is embracing the idea of a shutdown, but this time saying, blame the Democrats, don't blame me.
Yeah, how likely is it that any bill can pass at this point? We're seeing the Republicans, the traditional Republicans, finally peeling away, it seems, a bit from the president in a way that people expected to happen a long time ago and never did.
Well, peeling away in terms of voicing objection to the president's foreign policy, you're certainly seeing that. A lot of deep concern about the president's unilateral decision to pull out the 2,000 troops that are in Syria, which is giving up some leverage against Iran, and the decision to draw down the forces we have in Afghanistan. That's causing a lot of concern among traditional Republican defense hawks. What the president is talking like is more, in some ways, similar to what Obama promised, which was, I'll bring the troops home and end all conflicts. And that did not play out very well. And so the president is in this odd rhetorical and ideological spot where the president's own party isn't necessarily aligned with him. But whether those Republicans will actually peel away from him on this, on other bigger issues, yeah, and stand up and challenge him has been the constant question we've asked. And time again, when it comes to actually taking a vote, with the exception of health care, Republicans seem to have delivered for him.
They do get in line, yes. What are the impacts of a shutdown if we're going to have one? I mean, doesn't Homeland Security shut down as well, which basically puts security at risk, right? It's the thing that that President Trump says is at risk without his $5 billion.
Well, this is the great irony, is that this is not a full government shutdown. It's a quarter of the government, essentially, that would be unfunded and shut down. And so the White House is trying to already soften the blow, saying this would sort of be shutdown light. It wouldn't hurt as many people as past government shutdowns, but the people it will impact are those directly involved with Homeland Security, which is the agency that would remain unfunded. In other words, the people who work for Border Patrol would be the ones possibly facing not getting a paycheck at Christmas because the president is having a showdown over border security. So, this could be a real direct problem for those kind of immigration and Border Patrol agents in the next few weeks. But we'll also see, you know, Mick Mulvaney, the budget director, who's now also the chief of staff, can do some creative accounting. Is there a way where they make this less painful and therefore perhaps more palatable, even though for many, you know, getting a delayed paycheck is still a real hit?
Yeah. On to the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis resigned, and his resignation letter was actually released by the Pentagon, not the White House. Isn't that right? Isn't it kind of making it extremely clear that he can't support the president's policies? And has a Secretary of Defense ever resigned this way?
Well, I think you'd have to go back many, many years to see any kind of similar example. I believe if you went back to some of the back to the Jimmy Carter days to see this kind of public objection by the defense secretary to the commander in chief's decisions. But with this, as you say, the general, the defense secretary, Jim Mattis, made clear in his resignation letter that he was quitting. not retiring, as the president characterized it, but quitting based on some real fundamental differences with the president of the United States. And he made sure that letter was made public to make clear to those serving and to those the rest of the American people that his idea of America's place in the world is really at risk right now. He says America's abandoning its allies. He's not comfortable with that. He says he's really concerned about Russia and China and the threats they pose. And he's raising a red flag there to the president, who he seems to be suggesting is not taking that seriously.
For the last couple of years now, people, especially critics of the president, have talked about the fact that there need to be adults in the room. Chief of Staff John Kelly and Secretary of Defense James Mattis were kind of considered to be those adults in the room. They are both gone now. How does that change the administration?
It kind of puts a pin in that idea that you could have traditional national security hawks and Republicans who could reign in the present.
Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. Shockwaves in Washington, D.C. and around the world this morning as the U.S. government faces a shutdown and the Secretary of Defense suddenly resigns. Jim Mattis, the well-respected Secretary of Defense, said he will step down after the president stunned advisors with his decision earlier this week to pull all U.S. troops out of Syria. The president is also rumored to be ordering 7,000 troops out of Afghanistan. That's nearly half of the American forces. Secretary Mattis opposed both of those decisions. Joining us live is CBS military analyst Major Mike Lyons. Hey, Mike, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So has this ever happened before? A sitting Secretary of Defense publicly resigning, basically out of protest?
I'd have to go back and see in the archives, but it's not good for the president.
At least very unusual.
The letter's written.
Yeah, at least a very, very unusual move, right?
Yeah, especially the Secretary of Defense.
And it clearly appears to be, this letter of resignation came from the Pentagon, not from the White House. It clearly appears that this is, in a sense, a form of protest, not just a resignation, but it's being delivered as well with a message.
Yeah, for sure. And in fact, it was also written before. You wouldn't have been able to carve something like that up in the short time between when the president tweeted out about us leaving Syria. And I think it's the culmination. He likely had that in his pocket for a few months and just figured out when he was going to decide to do it. It looks like the Syria decision was the straw that broke the camel's back. Perhaps it is the planning for leaving Afghanistan as well, but it looks like the president's just not listening to his advisors and seems to be going in the other direction on some very serious matters.
It's been thought for a long time that Secretary Mattis's point of view is shared by many others who don't have the privilege or the ability to express their own points of view. Do you sense or do you know that behind the scenes that there is a lot of discord behind the scenes?
Well, I know that H.R. McMaster was someone that had the president's ear for a while and then for whatever reason fell out of favor as well. And it seems as though it just has to do with the president wants to hear certain things. And when you speak truth to power, it just doesn't always work out that way. So I think, the question is who replaces General Mattis? Is it someone that's just going to be a yes man and just ticket punch things for the president for what he wants to do, or someone that's going to be able to tell the world and tell the story and what's happening out there, and that way we make the best decisions possible? So we're at a real crossroads, I think, with regard to his cabinet.
Yeah. Are you worried?
Well, I'm concerned. I mean, I'm still, a big believer in the institutions, and one person doesn't make or break anything in our country. And I think that there's enough of a kind of guardrails in all the things that we have out there. So, but we have to see. We have to see the choice who replaces him. We have to see how the Department of Defense acts. I do think that was a good decision to leave Syria in terms of the amount of people that are there. I don't think we're making that much of a difference.
Mm-hmm.
We should have consulted with our allies, likely, and we should have done other things, not do foreign policy by tweet. I think that's probably the biggest thing.
Right. And aren't we in Syria without congressional approval to start with? I mean, many would argue this wasn't really a legal move in the first place, and it wasn't done in the traditional way. Yes,
we have a very thin resolution. It's based on the 2001 authorized use of military force, and basically a claim that Syria is you're right, a sovereign nation. We've got troops inside of a sovereign nation. What does that mean? But we've got a a resolution that was passed by Congress under the Obama administration, which is when they went in there, that basically says Syria is no longer a sovereign country. It's ungoverned land. That's where we're at. I mean, it's very thin. There's probably not a good legal basis for us being there.
Probably wouldn't hold up if challenged very forcefully. Is it time now to get out of Afghanistan as well?
Well, that's a different story because we've been there a lot longer, and it's you know, relying with the local government, we've just squandered that whole mission for the past 18 years, and it's a generational fight. We've not really moved it forward. The Taliban has a lot of negotiating power. The question is whether or not we can get them to the table and negotiate a deal that makes sense for us. Hard to say where we are. I think pulling troops out of there would be a mistake as well. We never should have, you go back to, we never should have pulled the troops out of Iraq. And the difference between the Iraq and Syria has got to do with, again, the support of the government. And when we were inside of Iraq, I fully figured we would keep a division there. 25,000 troops would have stayed in Iraq as a combat unit to secure the Middle East and keep things safe there. But when Barack Obama pulled them out of there, I think that changed the whole dynamic.
So this president has had, to say the least, a very complicated relationship with the military and with generals specifically. He seems to have a very hot-cold relationship, wanting to use them in terms of securing legitimacy for some of his policies, but also challenging them in many ways.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And he gets hot and cold. He gets on them and then, for whatever reason, doesn't like when they tell him something that he doesn't agree with. And you've heard him say things like he's smarter than the generals. And, you know, but there is something to be said for, you know, the bottom line is the foreign policy community in the past 20 years and the think tanks and all the elites have got a lot of things wrong. And they really haven't figured out what to do to get out of the things that they've gotten wrong for us. And I think the president looks at that and saying, well, you're no smarter than me, and that's just why I can make this decision as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much. CBS military analyst Major Mike Lyons, thanks, and good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
Bipartisanship. It's something that supposedly doesn't exist anymore, especially in Congress. But a major criminal justice reform bill was just passed by both houses this week, and the president supports it. It's called the First Step Act, and joining us is David Makin, a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at Washington State University. David, welcome, first of all. How are you doing this morning?
Well, thank you for having me.
Can you explain where the conservative consensus on this came from? Because I thought they were the tough on crime party.
Well, I think that in many ways, being tough on crime kind of runs against being fiscally conservative, and prisons are exceedingly costly. There's better and more effective, really cost-effective ways in dealing with crime, and I think that what you're seeing is many realizing that that's a reality, that we can both be tough and fiscally conservative.
How will this bill affect people who are currently in jail? This is just a federal for people serving federal sentences. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. So it only applies to federal prisoners, and you figure there's just over almost close to 200,000. We have, you know, more than 2 million Americans that are incarcerated. So in many ways, it's, no pun intended, it really is a first step. It really mm-hmm. demonstrates that the federal government sees this as being problematic, and we're seeing states start to realize that they cannot afford mass incarceration, and there are more effective ways of handling the problem.
Communities of color have been disproportionately affected by the war on drugs. Does this do anything to rectify that situation?
I think in many ways it gives more flexibility back to judges. We've certainly seen some changes around the sentencing disparity with crack and powder cocaine, particularly allowing the disparity, the retroactive changes. It's a step in the right direction. But in terms of addressing disparities, we really have to start looking at states. I think mm-hmm. far too often we look at federal, issues when the reality is that much of these are really states. They are states with significant problems. And this, if anything, demonstrates that you can get bipartisan support to really move towards a more equitable process.
Right. So this affects about 200,000 prisoners, I think you said, and states are holding close to 2 million. Isn't that right?
Correct.
It is a much bigger problem than this, but this, I guess, would be what you call a first step. I have Hannah Scott in the studio here. She's covered criminal justice reform in our state, and I think she has a few questions, too.
Good morning, David. So first off, let me just kind of follow up on what you just said. As far as states go, where would you say our state, Washington State, lies in this particular area of doing things like the first step?
Well, I think if you look at, for example, Initiative 940, right, and certainly there were some concerns about, you know, what this would really, at a more practical level, have in terms of officers' decision making. But I think we can certainly get behind the idea that we need to make changes when we see key problems. And in Washington, we saw some issues with particularly how police were interacting with different groups, and having training that is evaluated for it being effective, and we can show that it's being effective, puts us really in a better, in a better state to improve policing and reform criminal justice.
And use of force was a big part of I-940 that was passed, of course, by the voters here in this last election, because our state was ranked poorly. We had that malice standard, which we were the only one in the nation to have that malice standard, the need to prove malice in an officer-involved use of force. Then that will be stripped from us. So that has to improve our standing, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you look at the overwhelming support, and I think that's what's really telling about when you look at the First Step Act, you look at Initiative 940, when you look around the country, I mean, you look at what happened just down in Florida with felon disenfranchisement. And while that might be put on hold with a governor, it really does demonstrate that Americans realize that at the end of the day, the vast majority of the people who are incarcerated are coming home. They're coming back to our communities. How do we want them to come back? How do we want them to return? How do we want them to reintegrate? And we're starting to see that support. And I think that is it's a good statement around the holidays that, well, we can reflect on the greater good and what it takes to get there is that we all have to come together.
And one of the key parts of the I-940 was the other legislation that will eventually probably be passed in the legislature, the kind of complementing bill, clarifying bill of I-940, where law enforcement groups and those behind that initiative all did come together, just like you're talking about, to figure out a solution, what works best for law enforcement and what will work best for communities of color, those who interact with police and things like that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think when you see many of the incidents that really we call these the kind of catalyst events, I mean, they're horrible situations. They truly are. And what we're doing is recognizing that we need to rebuild trust. We need to focus on better training that helps de-escalate confrontations. And we know that the training that we offer officers works. I think that's one of the most pressing areas is that we throw a lot of training at police officers without any concern of how it actually, is it effective? Do they apply it in the field? And maybe more critically, if it's not working, how do we improve the ability to train officers to handle situations that they may not ever encounter or that they might encounter every day? I mean, policing is one of those incidents It's kind of like emergency room. You really never know what you're going to get. It can be boring for days on end, and then all of a sudden it's high, it's intense. And I don't think we do a great job preparing people to do that job.
And this training that comes with I-940 will absolutely do that. We've got the de-escalation training, and especially when we're talking about people with mental health issues, and that's a key part of this.
It is. But when you look at much of the training that we present to officers, it's really rarely evaluated in field. That is, if we send officers through, say, crisis intervention training or any of the different de-escalation trainings that are out there, do they apply it in the field as they interact with people? Because it's one thing to go and sit in a classroom and take a quiz at the end to say that you understand these six principles of what have you. And it's entirely different to be able to be trained, to be able to apply that training in the field. And that's something we're working out here at Washington State University is really how do we evaluate this training and improve this training by watching officers interact in the field. And I think that with I-940, it gives us an opportunity to really be on the precipice of improving police training that we hopefully will be able to apply across the nation.
Okay. Thank you so much, David Makin from WSU. Thanks for joining us. And Hannah, thank you as well.
And now for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Spring Free Trampoline. A heartwarming holiday tale via Twitter. Owen Williams posted a story about his neighbor, Ken. Owen first happened upon Ken, who was 83 at the time, when the octogenarian was on top of a 20-foot ladder working on his house. Owen would come to know that Ken Watson was a former salvage diver, seaman, carpenter, baker, and he played a mean accordion. The sounds of Oompa would drift through the shared kitchen wall late at night. But at 85, to stave off loneliness, the widower decided to take on serious adventures like skydiving and wing walking on the roof of a Boeing Stearman biplane. And Owen says Ken cozied up pretty quickly to their family dog, feeding her chocolate biscuits on their first meeting. It was love at first sight. And Ken loved Owen's 2-year-old daughter, Katie, too. Ken always told his family he'd live until he was 100 years old. Sadly, he didn't make it. He recently passed away from cancer. In a post on Monday, Owen wrote about a surprise visit from Ken's daughter after he died. She was loaded up with wrapped Christmas presents. Ken's daughter told Owen before he passed away, her father had bought 14 years worth of Christmas gifts for his 2-year-old daughter. Owen and his wife were overwhelmed by the gesture, and at first, they thought it would make a nice Christmas tradition to give their daughter a present from Ken every year for the next 14 years. But curiosity got the better of Owen, and they decided to open up just one of the gifts from Ken out of curiosity. It turned out to be a book called Christmas Eve at the Mellops, a story about a family of pigs and the importance of giving to others at Christmas time. They wondered about the wisdom of saving gifts that might be for a little girl. Would it make more sense to give them all to Katie now so she could enjoy them? Owen says they decided to ask the Twitter universe for help on what to do, open now or wait. Over 67,000 people voted on Twitter. They were so touched by the story. 31% said open now and rewrap. 69% said open the gifts one a year until 2032. Owen's latest tweet says they're definitely going to open one every year till 2032 and says it'll be their way of remembering an immensely generous gentleman.
What's the best way to reduce? Eat what you want or starve yourself? Starve yourself? Wrong. A half-empty stomach causes hunger tantrums. Now you can avoid hunger tantrums, lose weight naturally and fast. With the RDX Full Stomach Reducing Plan, you fill your stomach, yet fat just seems to melt away.
That sounds really good. That sounds like a quality product, if you ask me. Jim Dever here, sitting in for Dave Ross this morning. And what you shouldn't resolve to do in the new year is this. Go on a diet. Many of us struggle to get through the holidays with our waistlines intact. First, there's the sacks of candy on Halloween, and then the gravy walloped on Thanksgiving, and then there's Christmas with all the holiday parties and cookies in between, which means the number one item on our New Year's resolution always seems to be to go on a diet. But you shouldn't. No. According to Rebecca Scritchfield, who joins us now, she's a registered dietitian, nutritionist, certified exercise physiologist and author of the book Body Kindness, also host of a podcast with the same name. You are a busy woman, Rebecca, and I need you to tell us why we shouldn't be dieting as part of our resolution.
Well, hopefully this is really good news, you know, thinking that we enjoyed ourselves over the holidays and then we have something, you know, we've been bad and we have something to make up for. But believe it or not, if you really want to focus on your long-term health and building habits, dieting is the worst thing that you can do.
Really?
Because, yeah, I mean, they are, think about it. They're joyless. They're miserable. You feel like it's like a dead person's goal, right? I'll never have chocolate cake again.
Yeah.
It just doesn't go with the human brain. And so we definitely need to make changes, but following a diet, a lifestyle, you know, that's today's trend, a diet in disguise. Oh, we're not a diet. Just do this forever. It's still restriction and our brains do not like it. So we need to avoid it.
So what do we do? Say we do need to lose weight. What the heck can you do to make that happen?
Yeah, the first thing I want to let people know is most people over the holidays will experience some amount of weight gain, right? So we have fewer daylight hours, we're busier with parties and socializing, we're probably exercising less, we're staying up later, we are getting an extra energy from a couple extra alcoholic drinks or hot chocolate or cookies and those things. But that's part of the enjoyment of the season. Most people would maybe gain a couple of pounds as normal, and you lose that when you get back to your healthy routines that really generally make you feel good. So I'm talking some sleep, getting good sleep, staying hydrated. I'm a fan of kind of curbing back on alcohol because you don't need it to live, let's be honest. So if you feel motivated, some people do dryuary where they just don't drink in January.
Uh-huh.
I can support that, but you know, what you want to do is you want to take immediate action and things like you're gonna go work out, but try to do something that's a little bit more fun. If you think about it, it makes sense.
Okay.
If you'd enjoy listening to a new audiobook on a walk, you could be gone for an hour or two, and that is going to build like a positive brain connection that says, you know, I want more of this, so let me do it again. If you go all out and pull your hamstring, you're going to avoid the gym, and then you're going to be stuck.
Yeah, I like to listen to things when I'm out walking or running. Carolyn and Chris have joined us here, and I'm curious to know what your resolutions have been. And have you had resolutions in the past, health-related?
Well, I'm like Rebecca, where I think that balance, I've done all those like weird things where I'm like, okay, I'm not going to eat forever, and it's not sustainable, and it's not fun, it's not joyful. It's horrible. I think that I strive now for balance and just try to, you know, not hate myself,
Rebecca,
when I don't do the things.
It sounds to me like Carolyn's following your advice, Rebecca.
I am, yes.
I love it, girl. Keep it going.
Okay.
I've gotten to the point, Rebecca, where I just try to break even. Because I eat so poorly and I like to drink IPA, and then I run every day to barely kind of just keep an equilibrium. I know I'm on my way to the grave, but that's what I've picked out.
So, it's Sully's kind of balance, right?
Right. Well, and we are all on our way to the grave. I actually think it's kind of twisted where if you think about a lot of the health culture out today, it makes it sound like we can live forever, that we could somehow cheat death. And like, we're all renting space, and I'm saying have fun, and I'm saying care about your health, but when it approaches a level of anxiety, like food either adds to your health or takes away from it, and you're one step away from killing yourself in that last bite of brownie, you've gone too far, and now your mental health is messed up.
So you're not saying drop all resolutions that concern your health. You're just saying be reasonable about it. Don't be so diet focused in terms of diet in the sense of I'm going to lose weight on a program.
Yeah.
That's not a good
100%.
Way to go.
Like the way that my approach is really about working with your body and being good to it. So three simple things: make choices from a place of love. That might be when you go to bed, even though you want to stay up late and watch TV, and you don't eat in front of the TV because you know that you're full, and that's probably not the best idea to take in extra energy right before bedtime. Connect to your body, and so listen to it. So, you know, take care of it when it needs sleep. When it's hungry, eat. But if it's not hungry, just take a break from food and eating, and you will get hungry eventually, and then it'll be a good time to eat. And then the last one is be fully committed to taking good care of yourself. And the reality is, as humans, we are highly fallible. We will make mistakes. If you quit on any positive efforts early, it's never going to be a habit. You have to keep trying and kind of coach yourself. Hey, it's okay. You know, we'll try something else.
Okay. Thank you, Rebecca. Is there a website we can go to follow up with you?
Absolutely. Bodykindnessbook.com.
Okay. Thank you so much, Rebecca Scritchfield. Feel like I should be singing a holiday song. I feel a surge of deep satisfaction because the aforementioned Tom Tangney is here with a movie review. He'll answer the only question that people ask film critics these days. Is the new one as good as the old one? We're talking about the new Mary Poppins, of course, the latest in a long line of remakes. Tom?
Mary Poppins Returns, it's called. You know, a 10-year-old Tom Tangney could not get enough of the movie version of Mary Poppins when it first hit theaters. I learned how to play all the film songs on the piano and had earnest discussions with my fellow grade schoolers about whether supercalifragilisticexpialidocious or anti-disestablishmentarianism was the longest word in the English language. And then, of course, there was the beatific vision of Julie Andrews, practically perfect in every way. It would seem impossible to be able to recapture the magic of that 1964 gem a half century later. And sure enough, the 2018 sequel, Mary Poppins Returns, can't.
Oh.
It's a valiant effort, though. Very earnest in its homage to the original, but lacking both its winning charm and especially those buoyant songs. But it's not for a lack of trying. For starters, the storyline is quite psychologically astute for a children's film. The boy and girl in the original are now adults, the grown-up boy having three kids of his own. But tragedy has struck this Banks family, leaving the children motherless.
It's been a difficult year for our family. Everything's fallen to pieces since your mother.
I miss mother.
The family is coping as best it can, but then it gets an eviction notice at their home on Cherry Tree Lane. The Banks are at the breaking point when a long-ago nanny suddenly appears.
Mary.
Pines. What brings you here after all this time?
We've come to look after the Banks children.
Us?
Oh, yes, you too.
Mary Poppins, in her roundabout way, helps both generations of Banks cope with the loss of their most important person in their lives. That's arguably a richer premise than the originals. Now, as for the cast, Emily Blunt is probably a better actress than Julie Andrews, but she's not a better Mary Poppins. Andrews is incandescent in the part, charming, beguiling, and welcoming. Blunt is shrewder and more mysterious, and definitely not as much fun. Now, that may indeed be closer to author P.L. Travers' idea of Mary Poppins, but it's not Walt Disney's. And Lin-Manuel Miranda, as a kind of earthbound sidekick for Mary Poppins, is no match for Dick Van Dyke, who pops off the screen while Miranda blends into the background. But the sequel suffers most when it comes to comparing soundtracks. To be fair, composer Mark Shaiman, of Hairspray fame, by the way, offers up a number of reasonable facsimiles of some of the lesser songs from the original. The Chimney Sweep song and dance number Step in Time becomes a Lamplighter's anthem, Trip a Little Light Fantastic. Let's Go Fly a Kite as a nice companion piece in Nowhere to Go But Up. And the moving Feed the Birds is equal, if not surpassed, in the sequel's best song, The Place Where Lost Things Go.
Smiling from a star that she makes blue. She's always there, watching as you grow. Find her in the place where the lost things go.
That's a nice song and very meaty, but missing almost entirely are the delightfully catchy, frothy, gleeful songs that define the eternal appeal of Mary Poppins. Songs like A Spoonful of Sugar, of course.
For a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way.
And, of course, Chim Chimmery.
Chim Chimmery, Chim Chimmery, Chim Chimmery. When you're with a sweep, you're in glad company.
Nowhere is there a more happier crew
than them what sings Chim Chimmery, Chim Chimmery. Chim Chimmery, Chim Chimmery, Chim Chimmery.
And then finally,
it's supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious, if you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
You just can't beat that. Mary Poppins Returns is a dutiful sequel with passable songs, but what it lacks is the irresistible sense of fun that Julie Andrews and the Sherman Brothers songs brought to the one and only Mary Poppins. I'd be surprised if many 10-year-olds were out singing these new songs on today's playgrounds, let alone 50 years from now.
All right, so the big question, how many tangs, Tom?
I'm going to give it 2.5.
Wow.
That's it.
That's it. Now, listen, if you're a family and you're looking for family entertainment, I would not take the kids.
Yeah.
It's just not what it, you know, is cracked up to be if it's really a sequel.
Fair enough.
There are good things about it, but it's not that sense of joie de vivre that you get when you walk out of Mary Poppins. I think it'd be better to watch Mary Poppins at home on your
your
TV.
That's what I was thinking as you were doing this review. I thought, this review is really making me miss the original.
Yes,
but I guess you don't have to miss it. You can still watch the original.
That's right. And again, it's a good effort. It's not like just a toss-off. They clearly put a lot of time and energy into it. I just don't think it really comes off as flat. It's not entirely out of tune, but it's just kind of flat.
But for kids who have never seen Mary Poppins, the original, will they even know? Like, will they see this movie and say, this is, like, so good?
Yes. No, well, the thing is, I think they they won't be. When I saw Mary Poppins, remember there were a lot of kids' movies at the time when I was 10, and you didn't. Mary Poppins was one of the, you know, once in a generation kind of thing where you just sang all the songs. Maybe Sound of Music, I suppose, too. But it works its way into the political consciousness or the social consciousness of our. I don't think these songs are not that hummable. They're relatively forgettable. Now, I do think it's unfair. When you first hear a musical the first time, you don't know how catchy. So I've watched the movie twice and then listened to the soundtrack over and over again because there are some slightly catchy tunes, yeah. But there's just nothing of that kind of
spark.
Well,
sounds like you put the work in. Thanks so much, Tom. Tom Tangney.
Anytime.
Okay, from declaring an emergency to starting addiction treatment at the jail to dedicated outreach teams of social workers and sheriff's deputies, Snohomish County has been tackling the opioid and homelessness crisis head on. And next month, another key piece of that response will be up and running. Hannah Scott has joined us now with more. Hi, Hannah.
Right. Hi, good morning. So, Jim, the county has dedicated teams of social workers and sheriff deputies that go out on a daily basis to homeless encampments and other places where drug users, homeless, and those with mental health issues gather, and they try to build relationships and then coax them into treatment. When somebody accepts, they take them all the way through the assessment process. Then if it's an addiction issue, they help them get into treatment, housing, and everything down the line, sticking with them the whole time. Earlier this year, the county also repurposed an old 44-bed work release facility right across from the jail as a diversion center, where those folks dealing with addiction that come out of those homeless encampments with those embedded social worker teams can get treatment for up to 2 weeks, medication-based treatment with things like Suboxone. The third part of this plan, opening a resource center with all the services you can think of right across the street to help people get out of that diversion center or the jail, or even those just living on the streets, get connected with all the services they need for a gateway to a fresh start. But they needed a location. And Cammie Hart Anderson with Snohomish County Human Services Department says that's when they thought about the old Carnegie Library sitting right there on the county campus, empty.
The conversation and the idea about let's do something with that building, it's sitting there empty and there's so much need. It started in 2013. And so here we are 5 years later. And it was just piece by piece. And how are we going to make that happen? And it's all new for county government as well, to use a county facility and subcontract or lease it out to a nonprofit. You know, so you could imagine, we are a bureaucracy, and so we were able, by sitting down and having a conversation, figuring it out.
And now it is about to become a reality. The old historic building has been repurposed as the new Carnegie Resource Center and is set to open early next month and will be run by Pioneer Human Services, a nonprofit which the county is contracting with to run the center. At last night's open house, I caught up with Pioneer's Callie Vaughn to talk about the new resource center.
We're going to do amazing things. We're targeting to serve veterans, individuals experiencing chronic homelessness, people releasing from incarceration who have substance use disorder or mental health conditions or both.
As for the services they'll offer,
we've got everything from DSHS to community health centers to employment services to GED services. Really want to help people get back on their feet. We don't have things like sleeping bags and pairs of socks and stuff like that. We're really wanting to help people become self-sufficient.
The Snohomish County Jail Chief Anthony Aston says having this resource center is going to be huge.
What this means to us, it's like a one-stop shop of all the social services that we asked people to go get. So when we release somebody from jail, for instance, and we need to get them either to treatment, or they need identification, or their social security is expired, all these different services, we have an expectation, or had an expectation, to give them a bus pass and say, hey, make sure you make your next appointment. And these people may be chemical dependent, they may have mental health issues, they're homeless. So our expectations, they're going to go to make these appointments, and they weren't.
And he says that was a massive crack in the system. But when the resource center is open in a couple of weeks,
I'm going to be able, for instance, example of somebody in incarceration, we walk them right 75 feet right out into this place where all of those providers should be right here and serve their needs.
And Chief Aston says this will complement everything else the county is doing to address addiction and homelessness, including the medication-based treatment offered at his jail. But he did stop short of calling this the final piece of the puzzle.
It's a bigger piece of the puzzle. I mean, this, we almost can't ask for anything more than to have a diversion center, a jail that is offering all the services we possibly can inside of it, and then this one-stop shopping here. So is there always more? Yeah, we're always looking to improve. I think you should always strive to do better for the community.
And he's got very high hopes for what all of these efforts combined will be doing and what we might see a year from now.
I think we're going to see a much more positive outlook for our community out here. I think our homelessness, I would like to believe, is going to drop some form of a degree. And I believe that my recidivism rate, even though I know there's going to be recidivism, one of the key data points that I'm looking for is if I do have somebody that shows back up, are we got them clean and sober now, or are they in, at least in a different program? You know, I'm not worried about the more criminal element of it. We're just really trying to break an addiction cycle and a mental health cycle that's been left ignored.
And another person who has very high hopes, County Sheriff Ty Trenary.
And I don't want this to sound arrogant. Part of me hopes that we've got the right formula and maybe we help other counties. You know, what I don't want is, hey, come, you know, King County, come on up here. No, no, no. We have enough to worry about. And if we're successful, I'd like for us to be able to provide that model to other counties.
So it sounds like to me, Hannah, that they're really taking this approach seriously to go to the root of the problem, which is what there's always a lot of talk about that, isn't there, with homelessness. But in this case, it sounds like they really are. That is the primary focus of everything they're doing.
They are. And some of the differences that you'd see in Snohomish County compared to, let's say, King County is that, well, first of all, they're smaller. So we've got like 12,000 homeless here in King County. Mm-hmm. They've got about 1,000 up there in Snohomish County. But they have been on this for the last over a year. They declared an emergency more than a year ago that allowed them to combine and get some efforts all coordinated very quickly. They just extended that year for this year again. Okay. So they're coordinating those efforts. They've got this all of this stuff going on with the jail and the county sheriff and these embedded social worker teams, which I've had an opportunity to go out with, and they're just awesome. Yeah. It's Monday through Friday, right? That's their gig. They go out all over that county and they do outreach. And they, if they don't get a yes from that person right away, they clear them out. They clear them out of whatever encampments they are, and they have to move along. But they develop those relationships. It's the repeat contact with those people. Eventually, they'll get people to say yes, and then they stick with them, right? They get them to detox, and then they drive them to treatment after that, and then they drive them to some sober housing after that, and they follow up. And it's just this overall, everybody sitting down at the same table and communicating with one another and being on the same page that has seen really big success for them up there. And I think it will continue.
Great. I hope it works up there. And then we can adopt some of their practices here in Seattle.
And Sheriff Ty Trenary says he hopes he can be a model not just for King County and others in the state, but nationwide as well.
That would be great. Thanks so much, Hannah.
You bet.